Hello and welcome to Science World. Comet Ison that's now racing through our solar system is being called the comet of the century. An astronomer who's been keeping an eye on this approaching comet joins us later in our program and will provide some details on what we can expect as it nears us later this year. We'll take a look at the status of global immunization efforts in the fight against a disease that kills thousands of children every year. And we'll have another brain teaser for you with the Science World Quick Quiz. This and much more coming up for you on VOA Science Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, every 20 seconds a child dies from a disease that could have been prevented with a safe and effective vaccine. Rob Sivak, in this report by Carol Pearson, takes a look at the status of global immunization efforts and what is still needed to reduce the number of preventable deaths.
Measles is one of the leading causes of childhood deaths worldwide. Cynthia. Not only does measles kill, but it can leave children blind, deaf, or developmentally disabled, even while they're still in their mother's wombs. Yet the disease can be prevented with just two doses of a safe and inexpensive vaccine. When measles broke out in the U.S. state of North Carolina earlier this year, Pamela McCall was one of the health officials who tracked down the cases.
It is one of those immunizations that's required for school entry. So most children are vaccinated and most people have been vaccinated against it.
That's why fewer than a dozen people in North Carolina actually got the disease. In the U.S., vaccines have made many diseases rare or non-existent. Dr. Chesley Richards is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Vaccines have made an enormous impact on improving health in the United States. Diseases like smallpox, measles, polio, they've been eliminated or eradicated from the United States, and in the case of smallpox, it's been eradicated worldwide.
But there's much more to be done. A long-sought vaccine against malaria could save some of the more than 660,000 people, mostly children, killed each year by the mosquito-borne parasite. The Centers for Disease Control says vaccines give children a chance to grow up healthy, go to school, and improve their lives.
These are truly global health issues.
Dr. Anthony Fauci with the National Institutes of Health agrees.
If you had to pick out one intervention, if you balance the investment you make in the research and the implementation with the health benefit, vaccines have to be either the top or very much in the short list.
Since the Measles and Rubella initiative was launched 12 years ago, worldwide measles deaths have been reduced by nearly 75%, according to the CDC. Besides preventing many childhood diseases, vaccines also protect against hepatitis, influenza, and even cervical cancer. Soon they may free the world from the scourge of polio. Dr. Fauci says vaccines cut healthcare costs because preventing a disease is cheaper than treating one. The World Health Organization is urging countries around the world to invest more in immunization programs so more children can grow up healthy and strong. For producer Carol Pearson, I'm Rob Sivak, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists and agriculture experts met this past week to work out how to fight a deadly plant virus that has been annihilating cassava crops in East Africa for nearly a decade. And Luke has more from Dakar.
Cassava, a tropical root vegetable, could be the miracle crop of Africa. It grows well in poor quality soil and high temperatures, making it resistant to climate change. It requires little labor to grow. Its roots are rich in carbohydrates, vitamins, and minerals. It is already a dietary staple throughout the continent, and it could feed more. But cassava diseases have been shortchanging farmers in Africa for a century. One particularly deadly virus, cassava brown streak disease, began ravaging cassava fields in East Africa 10 years ago, and has now moved as far west as the Democratic Republic of Congo. Claude Fouquet is a plant virologist who heads the Global Cassava Partnership for the 21st Century.
The disease is not very obvious on the plant itself. The plants are going fairly well, but the disease is obvious on the roots when they harvest, but when they harvest, it's too late. So, in short, there is really nothing that farmers can do, and therefore solutions have to come from scientists and from different organizations that will be capable of offering farmers, you know, virus-free material and to select, to breed material, genotypes of cassava that would be resistant to the disease.
He said scientists have developed a strain of cassava that is resistant to the virus and are trying it out in Tanzania. They do that by either breeding existing virus-resistant strains together or genetically engineering new ones in the laboratory. They then must go village by village, getting farmers to plant that new super strain. Fouquet said this approach has been successful against cassava mosaic disease, also known as CMD. It is the most common cassava disease in Africa, and it is all over the continent. But CMD primarily damages the cassava plant, not the root. A farmer can usually salvage some of his harvest. Fouquet said that is not the case with brown streak disease.
The roots are completely necrotic, and therefore farmers, they lose absolutely everything. So the plant is growing, they work in the field, they weed, they spend a lot of energy, and a year or 18 months later when they harvest, all the roots are present but they are necrotic, and therefore they cannot eat them, they cannot process them, they cannot even feed animals, the animal will refuse to eat them as well. You go from having an harvest to having no harvest in one cycle.
Experts say brown streak disease could cut cassava production in half on the continent. As many as 300 million Africans could be affected. Fouquet said all it takes is one farmer sharing infected stem cuttings with another across the border or across the continent to accelerate the spread of the disease. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. Many of us who live along the east coast of the U.S. are getting ready for a massive invasion of insects that only make their presence known once every 13 to 17 years. While these large insects are pretty much harmless, they can often startle people when one happens to drop or land on or near someone. People often confuse these insects with other species and refer to them by the wrong name. What we'd like to know is the name of that insect. Are they A, cicadas, B, locusts, or C, leafhoppers? Do you think you have the right answer? We'll tell you in just a little bit.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Millions of girls in developing countries could soon have access to a vaccine that protects against cervical cancer. The Gavi Alliance has announced a record low price for the HPV vaccine. Joe DeCapua reports that despite the lower price, one group believes the cost is still too high.
About 275,000 women die of cervical cancer every year. Most of them are in developing countries. The HPV vaccine protects against the human papillomavirus that causes the majority of cases. The virus is sexually transmitted and can remain in the body for years before cancer develops. Dr. Seth Berkley is the CEO of the Gavi Alliance, a public-private partnership focusing on immunization.
Cervical cancer is a disease that in most of the wealthy countries is able to be diagnosed using very simple technology and is able to be treated if people have, you know, early cancers. We have a triple whammy in these countries where they have a higher incidence of disease, they don't have the diagnostic tests available, and they don't have treatment. So this is a disease that is killing women in the prime of their life.
Berkley says if no prevention measures are taken, the annual death toll could rise to about 500,000 in the coming decades. The vaccine is generally given to girls between the ages of 9 and 13.
We hope to take this vaccine by 2020 to 30 million girls in more than 40 countries.
Gavi launches that effort with demonstration programs in Kenya, followed by Ghana, Laos, Madagascar, Malawi, Niger, Sierra Leone, and Tanzania. Rwanda may soon start using the HPV vaccine as part of its national immunization campaign. All that's possible, says Berkeley, due to an agreement with the Merck and GSK pharmaceutical companies. They will sell the vaccine for $4.50 and $4.60 per dose, respectively. The vaccine costs more than $100 in developed countries, and the best public sector price before now has been $13 per dose. Not everyone is happy about the price of the vaccine. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, says the cost is still too high. Doctors Without Borders is calling on the pharmaceutical companies to be more transparent about research and development. Kate Elder is the vaccine's policy advisor for the MSF Access Campaign. She says much of the initial R&D for vaccines was done in public institutions, such as the National Institutes of Health. NIH is funded by taxpayers. What's more, it says the cost for immunizing each girl is really $14 because three doses of the vaccine are needed for full immunization. In developed countries, the risk for cervical cancer is frequently determined by using the Pap test or Pap smear. It examines cells from the cervix and can detect whether they are precancerous. The test is not widely available in many developing countries, preventing treatment at a very early stage of the disease. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
20 years ago, Pacific Gas and Electric paid hundreds of millions of dollars to settle legal claims by residents of Hinckley, California, that the utility company had poisoned their well water by improperly dumping industrial waste into the ground. Since then, the plume of contaminated groundwater continues to spread, and residents of the tiny town are leaving. Chris Richards reports.
Describe to your partner what a downpour would look like.
The first and second graders at the Hinckley School gather in pairs to practice their vocabulary words. It seems business as usual for now, but with so many families leaving town, the school is scheduled to close forever in June. Once each month, the school invites families to share lunch with their children. Roberta Walker came here recently to be with her grandchildren. In the 1990s, Walker was the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit by hundreds of Hinckley residents against PG&E for dumping cooling water from a natural gas compression plant south of town into unlined ponds. The waste, laden with toxic chromium-6, contaminated Hinckley's groundwater wells, and the suit blamed the company for the increased incidence of cancer and autoimmune disease that followed. The company settled. With her share of the money, Walker built new homes for herself and her daughters several kilometers from the contamination site. Now, chromium 6 has turned up in her well water again. PG&E has already agreed to buy out a third of Hinckley's residents. Company spokesman Jeff Smith has said repeatedly over the years that PG&E wants to make sure Hinckley survives. But that's getting more complicated.
We certainly remain committed to working with the people of Hinckley. If their preference is to have their property purchased and to depart from the community, you know, we want to make sure that we have that option available to them as well.
At the national level, the Environmental Protection Agency has spent 5 years studying new limits on chromium-6 in the environment. The EPA released a draft assessment in 2010, but that study is still under scientific review. The agency says it would be inappropriate to revise national drinking water standards until the process is complete. Under state orders, PG&E is still trying to clean up its mess. It's been pumping millions of liters of contaminated water into nearby alfalfa fields each year to let microbes in the soil break down the poison. The company also is pumping ethanol into the ground to trigger a chemical reaction designed to neutralize the chromium. At a public meeting in October, project engineer Kevin Sullivan offered this encouragement.
We're making a lot of progress. We've cleaned up like 54 acres. Now, I know that doesn't, I understand that if it's not your property, you know, what have you done for me lately? But 54 acres is a lot of progress.
But it's only a fraction of the environmental damage. 3 years ago, state water quality officials estimated the contamination plume was a little more than 4 kilometers long. According to the most recent state report, it may now stretch more than 11 kilometers, and Lori Kemper of the State Water Quality Board says it is spreading at more than half a meter per day.
It seems like the more we look, the more we're finding, and it's something that is scary, you know, for folks.
PG&E estimates it could take another 40 years to clean up all of the chromium-6 pollution. That draws grim laughter from people in Hinckley. They predict that within 10 years, their community will be a ghost town. For VOA News, I'm Chris Richard in Hinckley, California.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. A few minutes ago, we told you how many of us who live along the east coast of the U.S. are getting ready for a massive invasion of insects that come out of the ground every 13 to 17 years. Since some people mistake this species of insect for others, we wanted to know the name of the bug that will arrive by the billions in states from North Carolina to Connecticut. Are they A, cicadas, B, locusts, or C, leafhoppers? Well, the answer is A, cicadas. Although many people refer to and call them locusts, the two species of insect aren't even related. The cicada, by the way, is related to answer C, leafhoppers. With bulging bright red eyes and ranging in length between 2.5 and 5 centimeters, billions of cicadas will crawl out of their subterranean home soon, swarm the skies, and live above ground for a couple of months for one reason: to breed. The males of this species sing a special love song to attract mates, and when you get hundreds and hundreds of these bugs singing at the same time, the sound they generate can become very loud. In 2004, Gene Kritsky, an entomologist at the College of Mount St. Joseph in Cincinnati, measured cicadas' sound level at 94 decibels, saying it was so loud that you couldn't hear planes flying overhead. Thanks for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Since about the beginning of the year, there has been a growing buzz over the forthcoming approach of Comet Ison, or what some in the astronomy community are calling the Comet of the Century. It's not the first time that an approaching comet has earned such an awe-inspiring title, nor will it be the last. Some of the hyperbole and excitement surrounding comets has been justified over the years, such as it was with Comet McNaught, which was also known as the Great Comet of 2007. Astronomers noted that this comet did turn out to be the brightest that they had seen in over 40 years. Then there are those like Comet Kohoutek, that was hyped by the media back in 1973 as the comet of the century. However, Kohoutek turned out to be what most considered a total letdown, possibly because it started to break up a bit as the comet approached the sun just before its Earth flyby. Poor Comet Kohoutek soon after became the punchline for many comedians' jokes. So, will Comet Ison live up to the current hype and excitement that's greeting its upcoming arrival? We'll have to wait until nearly the end of the year when the comet will be most visible to those of us on Earth. Dr. Dennis Bodowitz, an astronomer from the University of Maryland, has been keeping a close eye on Comet Ison and says that it has the potential to be among the brightest comets of the last 50 years. Dr. Bodowitz joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about the comet that many expect will provide a spectacular show for us later this year. What is it, and why are some people calling it the Comet of the Century?
We started observing or seeing Comet Ison by the end of last year when it was really far away from Earth and the Sun, about five or six times the distance that the Earth is from the Sun. And it was already clearly active, and people started reconstructing its orbit and figuring out what was up with this comet. And if you do this and you reason forward in time, we think that this comet will become really bright by the time it gets close to the Sun.
When was it spotted? Who spotted it? And when was it determined that this could be the comet of the century?
This comet was spotted by two Russian amateur astronomers. And then when people went back into the archives, they found it in other observations as well. So it has allowed them to come up with a really accurate description of its orbit. And it was clear that this comet is the first time that it flies into our solar system. So it's a fresh comet from the Oort clouds, where comets reside. And when this orbit was done, it was also clear that this comet will get within 2 solar radii of the surface of the sun, which is really close to the sun. Doing the math, people found like it may become really bright.
The Hubble Space Telescope recently gave astronomers the clearest view of Comet Ison, and I believe it's making its way through the inner solar system. What did it look like?
The first thing I think people wanted to do is get an idea on how big the nucleus of Comet Ison actually is. Is this a really big comet, so several tens of kilometers, or is it a small piece? And this is important to know also whether it will survive its close approach to the sun. If you have a very big object, it's more likely that some of this will remain once it flies by the sun. The reason why you have to do that now is that if the comet becomes more active, there's this giant cloud of dust and gas that you cannot see through. And you cannot see the nucleus directly. This is a problem that we always have with comets. We mostly see the gas and dust around them. What Hubble found is that the comet was smaller than they could see, even with Hubble. So it means that it's at most 4 kilometers in diameter, which means it's relatively small.
So what contributes to a comet being bright or being spectacular? Is it? And you indicated that Ison seems to be, at this point, a very small-sized comet.
The problem with comets is a little bit of terminology. What we refer to as comets is the thing that you see in the sky, but that is actually the combined effort of both this small nucleus, typically just a few miles across, and this giant cloud of dust and gas. Now, what we mostly see when we look at comets just with our eyes, is sunlight that is reflected off of that dust, tiny, tiny micron-sized particles surrounding the nucleus in a cloud that is, as I said, thousands of kilometers or miles across. Now, if a comet is very active, which means it produces a lot of gas, it will kick up a lot of dust, and that dust then makes it a spectacular comet. Ison is far away from the sun, but it is already kicking up a lot of dust, both literally and figuratively. This dust is what we see, and therefore what we see is that Ison is a small body, but it's producing a large amount of dust, so that makes it look very relatively bright.
I understand the terminology being used to describe Comet Ison is it's a sun grazer comet, and I'm assuming from that title that it comes pretty close to the sun.
That is correct. Comet Ison will get within 2 solar radii of the solar surface.
So in other words, the sun could play an impact on the comet's trajectory, and I also have been reading that there's a possibility of the comet actually breaking up?
Yes. As for now, we simply don't know what will happen, and that's one of the things that makes this comet so unique. We never see comets that appear this far away. We can then follow it all the way in until it gets so close to the sun, and we're all speculating on whether it will survive or not, or break up as it does. So this is another opportunity for us to learn more about the internal structure of comets.
Now, how does Comet Ison so far, I know it's still coming in toward Earth, how does Comet Ison compare to other well-known comets like Halley's Comet, Comet Hale-Bopp, or even 2007's Comet McNaught, said to be one of the brightest comets we've seen to date?
Halley is quite an ordinary comet, except that we studied it really well, and it comes back every 8 years. This comet will not come back at least 1 million years, so we're not going to see it again. Also, Halley never gets as close as this comet to the sun, so it's a completely different beast as such.
Can you tell us about this Comet Ison observing campaign?
NASA realized in an early stage that this comet would offer unique opportunities, as I said, because it goes through these different regimes. You see it far away, you see it very close to the sun, it gets really bright. And what they tried to do is make sure that scientists would make the best of this apparition. So they've been telling people to apply for time on every possible telescope, to think about how you would study this, how you would use this opportunity. And this has had a big effect. Almost every telescope now has a program to study this comet. I've been studying it both with Hubble and with SWIFT, two space telescopes. We've been also studying with the Deep Impact spacecraft, which is a small comet hunting mission. There is even talk that spacecraft surrounding Mars now will observe the comet when it gets close. So NASA is really stimulating scientists around the world to do their best to study this comet.
When will it be in peak view for those of us sitting on good old planet Earth using consumer telescope, binoculars, or even the naked eye?
That's an easy one to remember. It will be Christmas Eve.
That was Dr. Dennis Bodowitz from the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.